and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today is October 29th, 2024, and this is episode 480. You're listening to Radio Warnerd. Subscribe at patreon.com/Radio Warnerd. I am the co-host, Mark Ames. I am here in Western New York. And I am on the line with the Warnerd, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, in the South Island of New Zealand. Hey, John. How you doing?
Hey. Yeah, we're down here in Dunedin. Very, very different from Queenstown, where we spent many months. Because the occasion for us being in Queenstown was that Catherine's brother was dying, and she's been up to the funeral. She's back. Now we're down in Dunedin, where I spent a decade. And the difference is I have these really proprietary feelings about Dunedin. Like, I went to the library here, and they've taken out the escalators. And I got really indignant. Like, they have no right to do that. The escalators belong there, and they can't just take them out. It messes with my memory.
Mm. So you will be leaving soon, right, from New Zealand to another part of the Five Eyes Empire.
Yeah, to Canada, because Catherine can't go into the U.S. because we could not leave during COVID. And
it's just
we
the
are
craziest
blamed for
thing.
That.
Yeah.
She's officially overstayed and she can't get back in. So, we're going to be in Vancouver for a while, and I'll just have to zip down to the U.S. On my own. But, yeah, I dread that flight. The Pacific, in case anybody wasn't aware of this, it's a big ocean.
It's giant, I know.
Yeah.
It goes on and on and on, yeah. It's sort of like the ocean in the days before there was land. It's so big, yeah. So real quickly, I want to, before we get to our interview with Ryan Grimm, I feel like I should clarify something that perhaps I wasn't clear enough about last episode. And that is this. If you're not a subscriber right now, you're just listening somehow or other, but you want to subscribe starting in November, you can subscribe. It's great. You can subscribe through any web browser. You know, your Chromes, your Safaris, your DuckDuckGoose, whatever the hell it is. Like, you can subscribe through your Android phone. You could subscribe using your app on your Android phone. You could subscribe using a web page on your, I believe, on your iPhone. But you can't use the Patreon app on your iPhone to subscribe to Radio Warnerd starting in November, because Apple is imposing a 30% rent tax on all business done through their app platforms. So, and there were some people who are like, oh, you mean we can't subscribe anymore starting in November? Or no, if you've already subscribed, you're fine. You don't need to do anything. You'll still be able to use the Patreon app on your iPhone to listen to Radio Warnerd. Still get all your episodes that, you've hopefully subscribed to you could use a podcast app, but if you use the Patreon app to listen to all your favorite shows, including Radio Warnerd, you'll still be able to listen to us on your iPhone Patreon app. The only thing is to buy basically a subscription. From now on, starting in November, if you're going to be a new subscriber, just do it any other way except from the Apple Patreon app. That's it. Hope that's clear enough, because I know some people got a little confused when I said that last time. Right. So I think with that out of the way, we can, as you can hear from my voice, by the way, I am still getting over the pneumonia that I had, the COVID pneumonia. I saw another doctor today, and he agrees we should may as well just call it some form of COVID. God only knows. Mm-hmm. But yeah, azithromycin works. It does clear up whatever fluids were building up in the folds of my left lung. Ooh. And The throat's a little groggy, but the rest is getting better. So let's get to our interview with previous Radio Warner guest, Ryan Grimm. He's got a great new site out, Dropsite News. But also Ryan, being in D.C., has a good view that we don't have on the U.S. elections, on presidential politics, on foreign policy politics. So let's get to our talk with Ryan Grimm. Okay, we are very excited to have back with us previous Radio Warner guest Ryan Grimm. Ryan was with us in episode 426, The Plot Against Pakistan. Ryan and Murtaza Hussain had broken these amazing series of stories about U.S., basically how the U.S. helped overthrow a democratically elected prime minister and popular in Pakistan in order to get Pakistan to go on board with America's and Biden's Ukraine war policies. And actually, I think we can even talk about some follow-up to that today. Ryan is the co-founder of new publication, excellent new publication, Dropsite News. So first of all, Ryan, thanks for coming back on Radio Warner.
Yeah, thanks for having me back here.
What we want to talk about today, you know, because we have to, because the whole world is stuck with whichever idiot is elected, we have to talk about the election. But first, if you wouldn't mind saying a few words about your new publication, Dropsite News, that you co-founded with Jeremy Scahill, I believe. Tell us a little bit about it, when you started it, and, you know, whatever else.
Yeah,
you want to say about
I guess
it.
The most important thing is it's address was dropsitenews.com. It was Jeremy Scahill, Noska Renner, myself, Murtaza Hussain, who you mentioned earlier, also yeah. Casey Quirk, a bunch of us from our previous publication, The Intercept, left and formed basically a new kind of investigative outlet that, you know, one difference you might say is that we really are trying to be kind of a platform for journalists all over the world, you know, whose voices really ought to be heard in, you know, the quarters of power here in the United States and among, you know, just a general readership, but kind of lack the access to that audience. And so, you know, we're pioneering that, obviously, in Gaza and in Lebanon, you know, partnering with a lot of journalists on the ground there and in the West Bank as well, and plan to kind of expand that more broadly. So actually, you know, you guys, I think, will, you know, be interested in a lot of the work that we'll be doing over the next couple of years. Obviously, we're doing it in South Asia as well, as you mentioned. You know, wherever the kind of U.S. gun is pointing, we're trying to find journalists on the other end of it.
Where
you
know, is
who have stories to tell? Good question.
I know you guys have done some great reporting on, you know, the big war, the Gaza, I don't know, Israel's wars, I think. I was thinking, like, you can't even call it the Gaza war anymore. It's just the wars.
No, it's spreading. You know?
There was actually a fight about it, that in the State Department press room today.
What was the fight?
Syed Erekat was saying, you know, you keep calling it a war. You can't call it a war. It's a slaughter. And Matt Miller said, well, Are you saying that there are zero Hamas fighters with guns who are shooting back? And Syed said, no, there are still Hamas fighters. And then Miller says, okay, well, then it's a war. Like, so they went back and forth on that.
So that means the Warsaw Ghetto, you know.
That was a war.
That was a war.
Right.
Jesus. Yeah, and the Nazis were self-defense. It's everything is so upside down. But you guys have done some really great gut-wrenching reporting out of Gaza with local reporters there. I think one of the major, you know, sub stories to the whole slaughter and genocide is what's happening. I wanted to get to this later, but let's just get to this now. What's happening in northern Gaza? You have a piece here, The Murderous Logistics of Israel's Ethnic Cleansing Campaign in Northern Gaza. Can you talk a bit about what's going on in northern Gaza?
That's actually one of the things that I asked about at the briefing today, because I pointed out that in this mid-October letter that I'm sure you guys talked about here, that was sent by, you know, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin and then Secretary of State Anthony Blinken to Israel, gave Israel 30 days to clean up their act on a variety of different measures. And two of the things that are included, there's basically three bullets and then an additional paragraph. Among those basically four things that are action items for Israel to address, or else the U.S. is threatening to cut off, you know, arms shipments. One of them raises the specter of a bill in the Knesset that was going to ban UNRWA,
right,
or was going to criminalize UNRWA. And the letter says, you know, you take all action, speak with lawmakers, take action by the prime minister, do what you need to do, whatever domestic politics you need to go through, you need to stop this bill from banning UNRWA from going through the Knesset. Of course, we know how that went. That bill went through. Bullet number three in that
the
letter.
The U.S. denounced it officially.
It did.
I was surprised. We never denounce anything Israel does. So that, yeah. Anyway.
They did. What made it so remarkable is that just 2 weeks ago, it was a key part of this letter. Like, do not do this thing.
Yeah.
And then 2 weeks later, they do the thing. One of the other bullets in there was, basically, you know, countermand these evacuation orders in northern Gaza. Do not do a forced expulsion of residents from North Gaza, and make sure that humanitarian organizations have continuous access to the people in northern Gaza. That was 2 weeks ago. Mm. You know, northern Gaza was in an awfully difficult, brutal situation 2 weeks ago. It was paradise compared to what northern Gaza looks like today. Like, the 2 weeks since they sent that letter asking them to back off of North Gaza has seen perhaps the most brutal violence of the entire year-long attack on Gaza. We've been in touch with doctors and medical staff at three different hospitals there that have just been utterly destroyed. And many of the medical staff that we were in touch with and others arrested, carried off. Some of them released, many others not. Patients left to die. Oxygen unit at Kamal Adwan Hospital bombed, and then patients, including children in the neonatal unit who relied on the oxygen from that unit, just dying. The descriptions coming out of North Gaza just defy the imagination. And just overnight, you heard of a bombing of a residential building with, you know, I think the death count is up to 109, maybe. It's maybe higher because I haven't checked in a couple hours.
Well, BBC, last I checked, was saying 93, but yeah.
Right. And there's no, so, you know, there's no kind of rescue teams that can get to these buildings. Yeah. And so in some ways, you're just kind of trying to figure out, okay, you know, who are we missing? Who's not here?
Yeah. Right.
And that's how you get to some of these tallies. For when you have some of these more devastating attacks. And it was right there in this letter that was this big deal, this big diplomatic deal signed by not low-level functionaries, but by the two most powerful, secretaries in the government, defense, and state, specifically telling them not to do this thing and instead to, you know, let aid in, let people return from there. Because the letter, it's a great letter. Like, if you read through the letter, you might think I wrote it. It talks about how there are some 2 million people on the coast now that have all gone there because Israel has made, you know, claims that they won't bomb that particular area, and that, you know, disease, malnourishment, and chaos is just running rampant there. But everything that they prescribe in the letter, everything that they say Israel ought to do to unwind this crisis, the description of the crisis is perfect, but all the prescriptions have been not only just ignored, but kind of flagrantly reversed in the opposite direction.
Well, that raises the age-old question in this war slaughter, which is how much of this is sort of, it doesn't sound like this is theater, because this is embarrassing, I would think, even to Blinken and Austin. But you know, it is the question everyone keeps asking, because it's such a joke by now. Biden acts angry and then gives them everything they want. Biden announces a red line at, like, Rafah. You can't attack Rafah. They raised Rafah to the ground. Mm-hmm. No red line. over and over. And then some stuff started leaking out that made it appear, but it kind of confirmed people's suspicions, like, you never meant any of this all along anyway. You know, you meant, you want to remake the Middle East. You want to use this opportunity to do all this. But it doesn't seem that simple either. What's your take?
It's an interesting question because on the one hand, they do have an incentive not to go down in history as the most feckless, you know, cabinet secretaries in 50 years. Like that's in their own personal interest.
Yeah.
Biden certainly over the spring and summer had an incentive to get this thing over.
Yeah.
Just politically, domestically, politically, even if the U.S. you know, structural geopolitical interests might clash with that. You know, he had his own interests, and oftentimes, you know, domestic political interests triumph. Elections triumph over what might be in the direct interest of the empire at any moment.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, here we are, where they don't get what they claim to want, and they continue to embarrass themselves. I think that my guess, I'm curious for your take, is that they just don't have an understanding of kind of what they've created with the Israeli military and Israeli policy, that because the U.S. has always been the one to stop every assault that Israel begins, that Israel just institutionally never developed any mechanism for figuring out how to stop an assault. Like their vision is, we have X amount of time. We don't know what X is to, you know, unleash as much carnage as possible. And then we're going to be told by the U.S. to stop. And so
we do as much as we can. And then we blame the U.S. for stopping us.
And then we throw a fit, but we stop.
Yeah.
And we now have blown that up.
Yeah, there has been an odd feeling of a sort of free shopping spree, except it, killing spree instead.
Yeah.
Like,
the shopper keeps expecting the buzzer to go.
Yeah. And it never does. But they don't.
Now they've hit another store.
Right. And they keep looking over their shoulder and it's like, here's some more baseball bats. Go knock it out another store, but you better stop it. Yeah. It is really strange. I mean, how much of this comes down to Biden's, you know, his state of mind and health on top of his deeply, deeply ingrained, you know, extreme Zionism.
You would think it has to have something to do with it. I mean, some of it was just a fundamental error. Let's pretend that they thought the bear, let's take for a second the idea seriously that they thought the bear hug would work.
Mm-hmm.
Like that was just a fundamental error.
Yeah.
Like that, you know, even if it was executed like a 55-year-old on ProVigil, like it would not have worked. Like a bear hug is not going to stop, you know, this bear. So I think that's part of it, that they had a fundamental just policy failure there. But I do think that ideology is probably the important factor there. You know, it's interesting to consider how this would have unfolded if Obama were still president.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious for your guys' take on this because you guys are no like champions of the foreign policy, I'm sure, of Barack Hussein Obama. However, like he, you know, at least since George H.W. Bush, you know, took the hardest line with the Israeli government, pushed the Iran deal through over
really
the objections of Netanyahu, would come after them, you know, would come after them publicly. Netanyahu got away with the 2014 assault for quite some time, but it wasn't anywhere near as long as this one. So you would think that even though all the structural conditions would be the same, if Obama was in office, I have a hard time imagining that a year plus after October 7th, that this is just getting worse and worse every day.
Well, it does make the U.S. look weak. I mean, and talking to other people we've spoken to in the region, you know, they say that to even, you know, pro-American kind of, you know, GCC states, it makes America look weak. But I'm not sure that Biden and Blinken maybe quite grasp that, or maybe they grasped it at some point and don't know how to change the direction of things.
You kind of wonder, like, don't you guys want to be a powerful empire? Isn't that your thing?
There's a sense that Obama in a very typical way for an American politician, gave way to Israeli interests because he felt it was that or be wiped off the map in American politics. But once he was out of power, and whenever he could, he sort of grumbled about having to do that all the time.
Interesting point that the Iran deal was after even his last midterm.
Right.
But so Biden has no
sense of that. He seems to be really like somebody who saw Exodus when he was like 15 and believed every scene.
Golda Meir has no idea how impactful that like 5-second conversation she had with this senator in 1973 was.
For him, it was like seeing the Beatles at, Candlestick Park.
It really was.
Yeah. But I think one place where they really met minds is that they both saw the Hamas attack as an absolute humiliation and violation. I mean, the Israelis saw it as a profound humiliation of their power and their sense of domination. And I think that Blinken and Biden saw it the same way, that Israel is essentially an extension of the U.S. empire. And it was a massive humiliation that had to be punished.
I think that's a really good point. Yeah. I mean, that wasn't supposed to happen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Hezbollah was supposed to be a formidable opponent, and they were next in line. Everybody was lined up for them. I mean, even Israel has shown that they were really focused on Hezbollah, but they chose to ignore Gaza because they didn't see it as a threat. And that was a deep humiliation and a real shock. I mean, 1,000 dead, that was a surprise to everybody, I think.
I think they deeply believe in Israelis. I mean, particularly Blinken and Biden and that generation, they still think of the Israelis as the Israelis of the 70s, these great fighters, hyper-rational, super technologically advanced, brilliant at everything, rather than, a bunch of foaming Trumpists to the right of Trump, and screw-ups and arrogant. And so I don't think they really know how to I think they're relying on the Israelis to know when power credibility has been restored. And they fear more than anything having some kind of open break with the Israelis, that would sort of almost undo all of the hard, dirty work done in their minds to restore credibility, power. Well, credibility is the shadow cast by power, as Dean Acheson said. And so if they have some kind of open break, that's exactly what Iran would want. That's exactly, I hear this a lot, exactly what Putin would want, that kind of shit. So they don't really know how to disengage themselves at all from the Israelis. And so it's very hard to kind of parse where they do split.
And they've caught themselves in this really interesting moment in time where kind of the hyperpolarization in the U.S. has now reached, foreign policy, which didn't used to be the case for the most part. It used to be that, that cliche about, partisanship stops at the water's edge was, fairly accurate, that you fought domestically over your domestic policy, but the parties agreed on what the U.S., war machine should be doing various places. That kind of still exists from the U.S. to Israel in that direction, but in the reverse, it's not the case anymore. Within Israel, there's a hyperpolarization where Israeli political structure doesn't like Democrats.
Yeah.
Like they consider Democrats to be all Rashida Tlaib, basically.
Yeah. They're all Hamas.
Yeah. They're all Hamas. And so you have this weird asymmetry where the U.S., from the Democratic Party in the U.S., is still, completely supportive of Likud and even parties to its right, even though they'll say, they'll criticize Smotrich or Ben-Gvir when they do embarrassing things. But, that's just around the edges. Whereas in the reverse, there's outward hostility to this party that is endlessly arming and funding the entire campaign. I don't imagine that this can, the contradictions are too grand for it to continue forever like this. At some point, there are going to be generations of Democrats who are like, no, we're like, we're not actually going to lose elections to support people that don't support us.
Right.
I mean, I read the comment section on the New York Times about For My Sins, and there is like this generational divide, which has been noted many times. Like, it's very difficult to get people my age to care about, basically Arab civilians being killed, because that was just a very incidental byproduct of the Cold War when they were growing up, or at least that's how they saw it. And they don't care. But what even the younger people on the centrist Democratic Party feel is rage at this distraction, which is effectively Trumpist. And it's really bizarre, because the people who do care about Arab casualties in Gaza and Lebanon and other parts of Palestine are by far more leftist than Biden's faction. But to the Biden faction, they are nothing but Trumpists in disguise, because they're going to change the focus.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, right. They're angry that it's happening.
Yeah.
That they have to think about it, when really, fascism is at the gates and everybody needs to be focused on that.
Right. How do you see this? This is something that we have talked about a bit, which is to say that Israel is on the road to becoming a one-party MAGA, issue. That Israel itself is already fully MAGA and has been for quite a while. Democrats are figuring it out. I mean, for Christ's sakes, like James Bamford's articles, showing how Netanyahu and Unit 8200 were the ones who used the Russian leaks and shared it with the Trump. Like, they did their best to help out Trump in 2016. And still the Democrats give them everything, which is kind of wild, but that's so deeply ingrained. I mean, is this generational for votes? Is this donor-led? Is this because the generational by politician? Like, at what point do you think this might change? And then also, I guess my other question is, do you think that this is going to be something that might cost them the election? I mean, we know that this could cost them Michigan, but if they went the other way, would it cost them the other way, I guess, would be the question.
So on the first question, I think it's partly generational, for sure. And then, if... There's also the fear factor of, is AIPAC going to decide that, my Democratic primary is one that they want to put $5 million into? Mm-hmm. So even as the politics change, kind of structurally, you still have, there's still that fear there. Right. And Democrats could say, they could find ways to basically ban that kind of outside spending within Democratic primaries. Mm-hmm. It's their primaries. They could do what they want with it. So maybe that's the only way you get there. Because as it is, there aren't many industries that do that. Like crypto is one.
Right.
NRA used to do it when it had a little more power. And then there's AIPAC. But it's basically unheard of for major corporations to do that. Like, they just don't. Coca-Cola, Big Pharma.
Enter into a primary, Democratic primary, and choose the more right-wing centrist candidate.
Right, they just don't do that. Right. Like, they have a policy where they want everyone voting for their Big Pharma legislation or whatever it is. And so they will shower everybody with money. But if there's a primary fight between two Democrats, pharma almost never is going to get involved with something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's really only a handful of groups that do that, and AIPAC being one of them. So as long as they're doing that, that's going to be inside people's heads. I do think, using kind of Trump's thing where he always says, well, if I was president, none of this would have happened. You know, if it had never happened, I do think Kamala Harris is probably a couple points higher up in the polls right now and is, you know, probably fairly comfortably ahead. Like, would be still close. It's a divided country. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a pretty significant drag on her. Plus, there are, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of people who might be volunteering for her, making small donors, like posting positive things about her on social media, you know, because she's not Donald Trump, but because she's tied into this genocide that they're not going to say anything at all.
Right.
They may end up even voting for her in the quiet of the ballot box.
Right.
Or they might leave it blank, might vote for Jill Stein, but they're certainly not going to be out there singing her praises.
Yeah.
And like doing the work to help boost her. I think there was a lot of fear that, like, particularly the Philadelphia suburbs would swing away from Harris if she became too critical of Israel. Like that's kind of the campaign's sense of it.
So the Philadelphia suburbs have a large Jewish and pro-Israel
and
population?
And a pretty pro-Israel
population. Why is that? Are they like people who are from Israel or something? Or just because most American Jews are pretty pro-Israel?
Yeah, I think yes. Like I think everybody's proud of the fact that there are lots of like Jewish students involved in the campus protests and so on.
Right.
But polling of the American Jewish community will find, you know, pretty significant majority support for Israel.
I think generational, it works.
And yes, they're older.
Yeah.
Like those people are 55, 60 and up.
Right.
So that's always how the campaign has kind of talked privately about it, that it's Michigan versus Pennsylvania.
Mm.
And that they, for just on a math equation, they figured Pennsylvania is probably closer, so they have less room for error there. Michigan, they're like, hey, maybe we can lose a whole bunch of it. Arab American votes and still hold Michigan, and also it means the status quo and supporting Biden. So, like, I think that's the basic calculus. But so that is
it. Really, just comes down to that. I mean, that's kind of crazy. Okay, yeah. Sorry for cutting you off.
Yeah, yeah.
That's kind of shocking.
And it's like these poor Pakistani diaspora. They're like located in like Texas, New Jersey, Washington State, Virginia, basically. And it's like, sorry guys, like those are not swing states.
Right.
So your issue with Imran Khan is not going to be something that the either presidential candidate is even aware of. If you all lived in Wisconsin,
right,
they'd care.
God. Yeah.
Should have thought about that when you moved here.
Yeah, yeah. Think about this. Move to a swing state if you want to. Yeah. God. This brings me to a question. Who's running Kamala Harris's campaign? Who are the people running it? Like, who made the decision that the best two people to bring to Michigan were Liz Cheney from the family of Arab, you know, Muslim murders, and Richie Torres, or, you know, whatever the hell that guy. Like,
yeah, I mean,
who's running it?
Send Liz Cheney somewhere else. I guess the chair is, I mean, it's all Biden's people.
Okay.
I think the chair is Jen O'Malley Dillon, who kind of ran Obama's 2012 reelection, and then she ran Beto's campaign until that one ran into the ground. And then Obama really likes her and is like, Obama suggested Beto, you know, use her. And then after Beto flamed out, you know, she went over to the 2020 Biden campaign and is now chair of the, you know, she's from Biden over to Harris. Like, so it's that same operation.
Okay.
But yeah, like there's other places you could send Richie Torres, you would think, right? Or other places you could send Liz Cheney.
Yeah. I mean, yeah,
there was an interesting little clip that was going around of a young Harris supporter screaming in the face of a little girl in a stroller.
Yes.
And screaming something like, I don't give a fuck about Gaza. And she added, bitch.
So,
I mean, she's getting real streety with this two-year-old. But I there seems to be a lot of that kind of rage. Like, there doesn't seem to be a lot of compassion at all in this demographic. Like, to me, it's familiar as something most boomers feel, but these people aren't boomers. I mean, this was a woman about 20, as far as you can tell.
Yeah, I think a Zoomer, yeah.
I mean, yeah, you can only understand it by getting into the depth of fear that so many people have about Trump coming back into office. And I think a lot of people have a hard time kind of connecting with the depth of that fear. But that will produce... if you literally do think that he's Hitler, mm-hmm. like if that's your actual belief,
yeah,
then you're probably right, right?
That baby's got to go down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Well, let's talk about Trump here a little bit. I mean, I guess the first question is, have you been able to parse a Trump or Trump admin policy on... on the Middle East, on Israel's wars? As far as I can tell, they think that Harris is a Palestinian and the Democrats aren't going far enough. But at the same time, they would end it, whatever the hell that means.
Yeah, he had that one exchange where he told reporters that that Biden's problem was that he was kind of too tough on Netanyahu and not letting Netanyahu like really let it rip.
Wow.
All the other times he says, I'm the candidate of peace. And when you press him on that, he says, well, it never would have happened without me and I'll end it. But there is real fear in the kind of Israeli political structure that Trump doesn't really have a plan, but would say, look, I said I was going to end this. We're ending this.
Right.
And I don't care what that means. Like this is done. You're done with this. So... what does that look like the next day?
Yeah.
I don't know. But the U.S. does have the power to say that.
Right.
And to make it happen. So in some ways, it could be as simple as Trump says. Now, would he do that? Who knows?
Yeah. What do you think? It's impossible to say, huh? Because he's so capricious.
Right. Yes. I do think it would be embarrassing to him personally if it went on for a very long time.
But he's going to be busy with other issues that would probably satisfy his audience enough that
rounding
he could afford
up
to ignore
right.
for a while.
Yes. Yeah, I think that, yes, if he wins, I think doing some type of performative sending of troops into American cities and going after immigrants is something that he will... absolutely do like that. Yep. That's I don't know if he can pull it off in any sizable fashion, but he'll definitely try and it will produce extraordinary scenes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like jackboots and people banging through doors.
And then they all have to react to him and everybody freaks out. And then that's exactly what he loves. And also doing that, it has other side benefits. It means you've involved the military in domestic affairs, and they start getting used to that, and that could make them a lot more useful 2 years and 4 years down the line with whatever he might.
Yeah, I guess his dream scenario would be if a bunch of top brass resigned in protest.
Right. Mm. Yeah.
Because otherwise the military is too much of a institutionalized bureaucracy for him to. Right. Be able to wrestle any control of it. But if hundreds of them started, just everybody's canceling their Washington Post subscription.
I know. Getting back to Trump again, I mean, one thing about this election that really stands out, it's an unusual election for the most obvious reason, which is, you had a zombie who was protected from a primary, and then they just installed Kamala Harrison as the candidate without any kind of even a pseudo primary, nothing to kind of prepare. And whatever the case, the result is, as far as I can tell, the most right wing election, between the top two candidates that I can remember. I would kind of compare it maybe to 2004 when Kerry was trying to prove that he was more warlike than Bush, and Bush's people somehow got this actual, you know, war. I don't know if you call him a hero or a criminal, but at least he was involved in the war. He didn't go fucking off in the Air Force or in the National Guard as Bush did. Anyway, they got him, you know, labeled as a traitor. But really, the most right-wing election since 2004, if not really kind of 1996, when Clinton just moved as far to the right as he possibly could to triangulate. And my own theory on this, I want to see what you think, is, I mean, look, when Trump ran in 2016, it was a very different campaign. He was running against Wall Street. He was running against corporate, like he was tapping mm-hmm. into so much anger that the Democrats wouldn't touch, were afraid of. He was running against, you know, free trade agreements. I mean, people maybe now take it more for granted, the sort of economic nationalism that Biden kind of, you know, helped cement. But like back in 2016, we were being told if Trump won and actually broke free trade agreements and started, you know, and imposed tariffs, that markets would collapse. And mm-hmm. that didn't happen. And now it's sort of, at least it was for a while, recognized maybe neoliberalism was creating deep political problems. So he won in 2016. And from what I've seen from kind of the Democratic elites and people I know, first of all, Trump's win in 2016 was for them like a KT event, like the Holocaust, right? I mean, it was the most shocking event, the 9/11 for mm-hmm. the kind of political establishment. And then what they thought was the public wants and needs something populist. And we can actually provide a more authentic, better, real populism because Trump's just a demagogue. And so on 2020, you know, everybody kind of moved Bernie-ward, and Biden, you know, passed some of the most progressive mm-hmm. domestic legislation in a long time. But this time around, Trump is I don't hear him talking at all about corporate power, about Wall Street at all. Free trade agreements, well, it's not as much of an issue. So he talks tariffs instead. I mean, most of his so-called populism is just empty the country of immigrants and then you'll have housing freed up and your wages will rise and that kind of thing. It's like the one answer. And it seems to, I mean, it's, I guess my point is this, that the Democrats moved left populist, not because of Bernie Sanders. I think we like to tell ourselves that, but because Trump. And now that Trump has mm-hmm. moved to the right, the Democrats almost with relief have moved right. way to the right to where the donors have always wanted them to be. Do you think that's right?
The interesting thing about that, it's like a footnote on that, is that there is a real anti-war right wing mm-hmm. that I don't remember for most of my lifetime in the U.S. Like, there's a real sense that along with his vengeance on everybody who annoyed them in the domestic U.S. polity, Trump would not donate endless billions to Ukraine. I think they care more about what they imagine is going on in Ukraine yeah. than Gaza for all kinds of reasons. But they're genuinely anti-war in that situation. And I think it made a lot of Trump fans sort of uncomfortable to find themselves being anti-war at first. But they've grown into it.
Well, they were anti-Syria for sure, and he didn't yeah. ramp that one up. That was like, that was the liberal internationalist war, and he, you know, and that was Hillary's, like, thing for if she were to win president, it was going to be another intervention. What do you think about all that?
I also think we sent so many people to Iraq and Afghanistan that we make fun of the phrase, there's a lived experience right. question yeah. here. Like, there's a real material factor yeah. that most of these right-wing people that you're talking about, they actually know people who went to Iraq or Afghanistan or went there themselves.
Yeah.
And nobody who went there mm-hmm. is glad that we were there or thinks that we should have been there or right. thinks that we should have done it again. We understand that in post-Vietnam, the post-Vietnam era, that was a period of a draft. So like the whole country kind of participated and knew people that were there.
Right.
But when it comes to Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, it's more people who are now are either right-wing independents or are Republicans. And so I think Democrats, because their kids or they themselves, you know, they don't
That's a really good point. Yeah. It's the education.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
Right? Because white, non-college educated, which would tend to be the people who mm-hmm. volunteered, right, are much more Republican. The Democrats lost them. Whereas the more highly educated have all moved to the Democrats. And they would not know somebody.
Right. And so these highly educated people are like, why? Gee, it's so weird. Why are all these people so like against war all of a sudden? Right. And it's like, oh, well, because it's awful.
Yeah.
And they know people that did it.
But what do you think about the economic nationalism side? I mean, and the so-called populism of, well, yeah, Trump doesn't do it anymore, but like J.D. Vance still has kind of pushed it to the next level, if you believe him. I don't know what the hell to think about the guy. I think you in D.C. would know better, but is there any of that left?
It's hard to know. People who know him swear up and down he's sincere about this. He's one of the few that actually still does talk about it. You know, Trump never talks about it. There's this, I listened to this one speech that he gave where he was tasked with like rolling out his populist approach that he was going to take to Medicare and Social Security and how he was going to expand them and protect them and, you know, add, he's going to, you know, he's talked about how he's going to even like protect and expand Obamacare and his trade deals and the economic populism. It was like his major speech that he promised he was going to give on this. And you could, the times that he's reading off the teleprompter, he's saying all of this populist stuff and he's just totally bored by it. And then as soon as he can get to like something about immigration and talk about lurid, you know, victims of rape and murder at the hands of immigrants, mm-hmm. like, he lights up and then sticks with that theme for like 30 minutes. And then you can see him go back on the teleprompter again. And that basically is kind of Trump's populism at this point. He knows, and I think he knows that his audience is on Social Security and wants it to be protected.
Right.
But what they really want to hear from him is the lurid stuff.
That's pretty grim.
Yes.
Nothing, you know, no offense to your name or anything, but that is
a couple months ago,
grim.
That speech, maybe 6 weeks ago or something, he gave that speech. It was funny isn't the word, but it was like, it was so transparent what he was interested in and what he wasn't.
So, I mean, just real quickly, Lena Khan, probably the only, can you describe her real quickly? Because she's kind of an amazing figure.
It's quite something. I saw a funny meme. It's like this like completely dilapidated house with a broken down garage. And in it is like a Lamborghini. And somebody said like, it's Lena Khan in the Biden administration. she's 35-year-old, I believe, head of the chair of the Federal Trade Commission. There was a huge K Street campaign to prevent her from even getting onto the FTC. Biden named her there anyway after his administration tried to name a bunch of other people, but they all got kind of taken out for being corporate stooges. And so she gets in and then he names her chair and a bunch of Republicans like freaked out and said, it's not, you know, we were willing to put her on the FTC, but not if we knew she was going to be chair. But to J.D. Vance's credit, he continues to say nice things about her. And she has gone hard at Amazon, Google, blocking a bunch of mergers, successfully blocking mergers. She will file suits to block mergers. Wall Street Journal and Bloomberg and everybody will make fun of her and say that the suit is trivial and without merit and will be laughed out of court. And then the court will agree with her and block the merger. And in a lot of these cases, the share prices of these companies go up. There's nothing inherently kind of left-wing about what she's doing even. Like there is a right-wing case for, you know, supporting the actual working of the free market, like, you know, creating competition.
It's a monopoly, creating competition.
And so I think to your point about there being no primary and this being the most kind of right-wing general election, in a primary, she would have had to commit to reappointing Lena Khan and Jonathan Cantor over at the Department of Justice.
Kamala Harris would have had to.
Kamala Harris would have had to. Like everybody running in the primary would have gotten asked and if you say you're not, like it becomes this like signal that you're going to break with Biden on one of the few things that people like about what he's doing in the administration. But because she didn't have to compete. So I guess, you know, credit to our, you know, kind of, you know, pitiful little democratic system that we have, because the absence of it is reflected in how she's positioning herself on it now. She feels like she doesn't have to answer the question. You know, the hope among people who are supporters of Khan is that there's just no advantage politically in her saying something one way or the other. You know, if she says she supports Khan, Mark Cuban and Reid Hoffman and all her billionaire backers lose their minds.
Yeah.
If she says she opposes Khan, she loses actual votes. People get mad at her.
Yeah.
So she's just saying nothing.
Right.
And the word from inside her campaign, like from the Brian Deese's, the people that run her economic policy, that they're all supportive of Lina Khan.
Mm.
And I do think it would be very hard for her to actually get rid of her.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe she could have a better chance of getting rid of Jonathan Cantor. He's the head of antitrust at the DOJ, and they hate him just as much. But he's a white guy, so like their passion for their hatred is like drained a little bit.
Right.
But you know, paradoxically, as a result, they might actually be able to take him out, because I don't think it was foolish of them to elevate her in the way that they did. Like, you're a billionaire, like. You have access to all these back rooms. That's where you're supposed to do your dirty work.
Why did they do it like that? And why didn't they give Biden flack like before Biden dropped out over Lina Khan?
Oh, they did.
Or did they? Okay, I didn't hear it publicly, I guess.
Yeah, so. I mean, there's certainly, like, I think the Wall Street Journal has run an average of three a week against her.
I'm sorry. I mean, why didn't Democratic donors, Democratic billionaire donors.
I think they were doing it more. I think they knew there was nothing they could do in between elections. And so now was the time that they could do it. But I think they're, you know, I think these men are just too emotional, like the Reid Hoffmans and Mark. Like, they just hate her. And it was against their own interests. Like, they would have been smarter to do this quietly.
Right.
That's why men can't be trusted with power.
Yeah, exactly. People who are not in America, just real briefly about Lina Khan, we'll move on. I mean, she's one of these rare, you know, heads of one of these agencies that actually grew out of, you know, the populist and progressive movements and had a lot of teeth until the Reagan era. And since then, we've just not even really thought about them much. There's been no antitrust enforcement pretty much since
Reagan. Corporate America won a bipartisan consensus that there really shouldn't be any enforcement. And the movement that Lina Khan is kind of at the head of is trying to do the same thing in reverse and create like a bipartisan consensus that there should be antitrust enforcement, so that even as the administration switches, if you empower the kind of J.D. Vances of the Republican Party, that you'd have, because it is like it's kind of a fundamentally right wing thing, like John Kenneth Galbraith and all those types that supported, you know, huge corporations in a marriage with huge government, you know, would hate the kind of whole philosophy behind this and see it as fundamentally right wing, and so
I think it's genuinely populist. I mean, big corporations have never been popular in this country. Going way back, there's not a whole lot of kind of mass politics of anti-big corporate power anymore. But Trump definitely tapped into that in 2016. But the thing is, Biden's politics were kind of going there, but there's very little rhetoric to go with it. You know, it just there wasn't a whole lot of kind of like grassroots.
A lot of style.
But the other thing about Lina Khan, on top of busting big trusts. Is that she's done littler things that actually affect people's lives for the better, which is the rarest thing, I think, for a government official. Like, for example, I think she was her, right, who just sort of passed this new rule because it's so hard when you subscribe to something online, you can never find, or they put up every roadblock to unsubscribe. It's impossible to cancel your subscription. And so she's just passed basically a rule. It has to be as easy to unsubscribe as it is to subscribe. Yeah. Now, this may sound small time, but these are the little things that piss people off. And if somebody changes that, it's like, wow, you can actually just write a rule and I don't know, protect regular people from some real inconvenience. It's kind of amazing.
You can actually use government for good.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty wild.
There's one national gym where like people were figuring out like because California had a good law about canceling a gym membership, you had to, like it was easier to like move to California and then cancel your gym membership and then move back.
Jesus. Wow. Yeah, I'm not surprised. Gyms are the worst at this. Yeah. Let's talk about, I mean, on the subject of populism, the Senate race in Nebraska. So, you're the one that turned me on to this story. It hasn't been getting a whole lot of play in the media, which is kind of surprising. It's a very interesting story. Can you tell us about it a little bit?
Yeah, it's this guy who's, Democrats are not even running a candidate in Nebraska because they concluded a year ago that they weren't going to be able to compete with this guy, Dan Osborne, who's kind of a Navy veteran. He was an industrial mechanic for 20 years at the Omaha's Kellogg's plant when they had a big strike in 2021. He led the strike, and it was a successful strike, great contract for all of the workers, so much so that they even ended up firing or pushing him out after that. And he's running as an independent and polling even.
And what's his message? What's his politics? Because some people say, oh, well, he's actually, though, basically a Republican. But it's like kind of bullshit. He's anti-corporate, anti-rich, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Joe Manchin is just like, he's pro-business and hostile to the welfare state and like was constantly fighting against unemployment benefits or, you know, trying to cut the deficit. Mm. Joe Manchin's now technically an independent too. But yeah, he's a right-wing kind of anti-populist. Whereas Osborne, he's hostile to corporate power, obviously pro-labor. He's an actual labor leader.
Right.
He speaks like a cultural conservative. Mm-hmm. He calls himself pro-life. But when it comes to how the law should approach social issues, he's basically a libertarian, which is kind of how a lot of people in Nebraska are. Like they themselves are socially conservative, but they're also like, you know, don't tread on me, leave me alone about this stuff. Do what you need to do as long as you're not hurting anybody. So you know, it's a pretty potent combination. The Republicans are running massive ads with Trump calling him a Democrat in disguise. And that probably will be enough to sink him because there's so many Republicans, but maybe not. Like it's at least three polls are out with him in the lead. One of them even had him at 50%.
Wow.
Without the awful branding of the Democratic Party, you know, it shows that those are the politics that have majoritarian support, like in this country, if you can somehow break out of the kind of branding.
Right. The only really big negative thing is if there's any whiff of Democratic Party to him, which he had already, you know, shed that, but it doesn't.
Right. It may be the one thing that Democrats, but yeah, but it'll still be too much to.
Yeah. That's amazing. So let's get to the election now. And you know, got to ask it, like, who do you think is going to win? What is it looking like? Like what does it hinge on, or which states or whatever do you think it really hinges on?
Yeah. I mean, everything's going to be so close. All of them, like Pennsylvania, Georgia, you know, if either one loses both of those early, you know, that's a disaster for them. Michigan is such a wild card, you know, cause you know, she could win these others, but then still lose Michigan because of her genocidal, you know, support of the genocide.
Yeah.
Nevada's a mess. Democrats thought they had that, but it's looking bad. Anyway,
they're going to win the Senate in Nevada, though, right?
I think so, yeah. It really could go either way. You know, one way to think about it is that pollsters and the media did underestimate the power and the strength of women voters in 2018, 2020, and 2022, and there's been no kind of public reckoning with that.
Mm-hmm.
So if they miss that again, then that's to Kamala's advantage. But boy, Trump's also like he's not surging isn't the right word, but he's climbing. Like,
yes.
He has the momentum that you would want at this time.
Yeah.
And Kamala doesn't have the lead to kind of suffer that.
There was that sense that they were trying to create that a lot of people bought into at the Democratic convention, that Trump this time Trump really is over. And it's not that we fear. I remember seeing some people like it. We don't even fear him anymore. He's just kind of yesterday's joke. Like they were starting to really convince themselves. But the polls, there was at least some polling to kind of back it up. He looked like he was kind of floundering for a bit. But as far as I can tell, well, I don't. Do you ever listen to right wing radio? Because I do every now and then.
Sometimes.
It's very instructive and helpful to do. It's sort of like John listening to or reading comments, you know, in different media and the MSN.com or Yahoo News or whatever. Because from the way they talk, it's the way they talk about Harris and Biden. It's that they're communists. They're Hamas and they're communists.
Yes.
And they will destroy America. So there is that same, you know, mirror image of the fear that on that side that they push on their, at least on their base.
In those comment sections as well, like Kamala will be the apocalypse.
Yeah.
You know,
the last election.
I wish.
The last election, yeah.
But no.
Yeah. But they do, I'm saying that is the line they push, which is, you know, it's similar to the, if you know, we have the Timothy Snyders and so on saying if Trump wins, he's going to end democracy and impose authority. You know, and then, I mean, when he talks about introducing U.S. troops into the streets, it's goes from the theoretical.
It's crazy. But both sides say that this will be the last election if the other side wins, which that's a dangerous thing for them both to believe, even though they're both, you know, wrong about that. Like, that's not going to happen. By the way, I should get going because I got to go cover this Kamala rally, actually.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. Well, let's let you go there. So I guess you're not going to make a call then. It's just too close to even throw out there a prediction. Like,
and maybe Kamala. I don't know. Maybe Trump.
Yeah. One of the two.
Yes. All right. Can I make both calls and then point to one of them?
Yes.
Yeah.
And we'll post it later. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. We'll let you go, Ryan. Thank you so much for coming on the show to talk about this wretched election that's coming up. This was Ryan Grimm from Dropsite News. We'll post links. And thanks again for coming on. Talk to you soon. Bye, Ryan.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
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 Okay. Let's take a quick break. Listen to some music from our man, Brendan Anderig, and we'll come back and finish it up. Thank you. Okay, that was music from Brendan Anderegg. People often ask for a link where they can find his music, so we'll make sure there's a link in this episode. I have to say I'm with Ryan. You can't call the election. I mean, you can go on record saying one or the other, like the proverbial monkey throwing the dart. And I kind of feel like doing that. But I don't know.
Throw the dart.
Yeah. Okay. So I feel like, my mind tells me that Trump's going to win. It's not really my mind. It's one part of my mind. One part that's dripping. Yeah. One lobe, you know, it's like in that Star Trek where the lobes light up, you know, this glass enclosed brains. But, you know, I feel like because the world always goes back, it's not that there's anything good about Kamala Harris, just the direction of things would say we not only get Trump, but we get the worst of all Trumps because he's so much worse now than he ever was.
He's in a bad mood now.
Yeah.
That's a funny idea. Like we had the good Trump tripping through the meadows, spraying flowers, and now we get the bad Trump.
Yeah, I am your vengeance. Didn't he say something like that?
Yeah,
that's. I think that is does seem to be what motivates him.
And it doesn't even have to be his own. It's like he's so plugged into his followers' responses, and he needs that constant little jolt from them that he would do what they want. And what they want is vengeance. So,
I mean, what we have is a kind of half-demented version of him too. I mean, he's not as sharp as he used to be.
No,
he's not. You know, he got flayed by Kamala in the debate. I don't know if you saw any of it.
It was
brutal. It was pretty brutal. You know, I thought it. Anyway.
Yeah, she really was like someone half his age. Not doing the sort of sharp mockery, but the okay, grandpa, let's get you to bed meme.
yeah, it was, and Trump just wasn't funny, you know, and that's the thing. Trump is the best. Trump is the Trump that is funny and shocking and takes on things that you really wish somebody would have said or done, but you never imagined it would ever, ever happen.
And when he just went down the list of his rivals in the early GOP debates, I admit that was kind
of thrilling.
Wonderful.
It was thrilling. Yeah, just taking these people out one by one. They were all really horrible, and they all seemed like they were invulnerable. That you couldn't
and
do
they
that.
They couldn't face it.
Did
you just insult me in colloquial American English?
Yeah.
You can't do that.
You can't do that. Don't you know the politeies that we all speak? Yeah. No, I don't know. I kind of feel like he's going to win, but and if we get Kamala, you know, it's just going to be a worse version of Biden. That's all
I
can
see. That's something that you were saying that was really interesting to me.
Yeah.
That you follow some Israeli accounts that see her as Hamas.
I never
got that sense at all.
No, but they we were talking about this. We should have mentioned this with Ryan. I would have liked to have seen what he said, but they hate her. They really believe because they sort of grudgingly tolerate Biden. Yes, he's given them every single thing they wanted, unlike any other president. Yes, he's humiliated the living shit out. Yes, they could not get better possibly than Biden, but his party is full of Hamas in their minds. And Kamala, though, did the thing that they worry about. Kamala, first of all, is a woman of color, and that already worries them. And she has, in this very kind of Veep / in the loop way, communicated a very fake but deliberate sort of, we must feel empathy for the suffering. I don't even know if she would name Palestinians, but, you know, basically for the suffering of, you know, families in Gaza. And right. to Israelis, to I follow like liberal, some liberal Zionist accounts, which you know, when after October 7th, they became you know, stark raving mad like everybody else. But to them, that was code. That was code for Hamas. Like, if you, it's not that they believe that Kamala Harris has any sympathy or any empathy for Palestinians, and I personally doubt she does. I think they're right on that. But in their minds, like, nobody really does. What it is it is signaling something that is dangerous to Israel, that is some kind of treason, some kind of stab in the back, some kind of something which in their minds it all comes under the umbrella of Hamas. And so she's Hamas.
Yeah. Wow. It's kind of that crazy. Is extraordinary. And yeah. it's kind of telling that any sign of empathy instantly
yeah.
veers into Hamas support.
Yeah.
That's really strange.
What they much more appreciated was John Kirby. That's their kind of guy. Or Biden, when being presented with, you know, the figures from the Gaza Health Ministry. This is like in November when it was so much lower, but these shocking numbers of how many people have been killed. And he said, it's all fake. It's run by Hamas. That's the kind of thing that makes Israelis feel good
right.
and secure. But if somebody were to say, actually, those numbers have been verified by the State Department, by the UN, by others, that is... yeah, that's code for I'm Hamas and, you know, we're out to get you. Yeah. Grim stuff, yeah. And Trump, they don't worry about him being Hamas because the biggest epithet, I don't know if you've noticed this, that the Republicans use, Trump and J.D. Vance, is calling your opponent Palestinian. Anybody you don't like, you just call him Palestinian.
Wow.
They don't call him Hamas.
I haven't seen
yeah.
that.
Oh, all the time, yeah. She's Palestinian. They're Palestinian. Kamala is Palestinian. They just use that as an epithet.
Wow. So nobody wants to court the Palestinians. There's all this fear that I did notice initially about the Palestinians or the Palestinians in Michigan. But
what Trump is doing, he does it both ways. I mean, this is one of his strengths because he's such a in-your-face, you know I'm grifting and I know I'm grifting. He can do this sort of thing, which is he also, on top of calling people he doesn't like Palestinians, he also has been sending out big messages to the Arab community there, Arab-American community, Muslim-American community. Kamala is going around with Liz Cheney. The Cheney family are the biggest losers, and they kill more Muslims than anybody. You don't want to vote for them. They're Muslim killers. She's with Muslim killers. Vote for me. Arabs, all America, all the Arab Americans, vote for me.
That was a good Trump M sound. Muslim. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what he's doing. And to be honest, it's effective. I mean,
right. Especially when you mention Muslim Americans rather than just Palestinian Americans. There are a lot of non-Palestinian American Muslims who
yes.
have the right to a real grudge about what the U.S. did in other parts of the world.
Yeah.
I would think, and we didn't have time to get into this in the interview, is that there are going to be a lot of younger Democratic apparatchiks who are going to be kind of pissed off with
yes.
Likud and Bibi for getting them into a very tight spot with absolutely no worries about how they'll get out of it.
It's a good kind of question to consider. So if the Democrats lose, first of all, who are they going to blame? Muslims are screwed in this election because, yeah. I mean, they're screwed anyway, right? I mean, Kamala's is helping lead a genocide, you know? And I have to say, just as a sidebar here, like, it makes sense to not vote for Kamala. Like, if I've had people say this, you know, to me, like, oh, well, all you're doing is getting Trump. And I just said, look, man, if my government was arming and funding a genocide of Jews, I don't care who's in power, like, I would not vote for whoever the fuck that was. And I don't blame anybody, and particularly Muslims, particularly Palestinians, who are going to say, fuck you. Like, yeah, Trump may be worse. He may kill some more people, but you do not vote for the person who is committing, arming, backing, supporting a genocide of your people. Now, humans shouldn't vote for somebody supporting a genocide.
I keep remembering this little Ursula Le Guin parable, which was found in every Norton anthology of short prose that ever came out. And people at Berkeley at 19 worshiped this and could not imagine disagreeing with it. It's about somebody who, in this happy little village, discovers that there's one child who's being abused and kept in a dark, dirty shed and fed scraps and beaten. And for that reason, they walk away from this paradisical village. And everyone genuflected to that idea. And it's been really strange to see people who I'm sure went through those same composition courses where they studied that little vignette suddenly turn into hard-nosed politicians.
Yeah, you know? Political consultants.
Yeah.
No, we got to do this. Yeah, it's let's be honest, it's because of racism, and specifically anti-Arab racism. Because, A, the U.S. wouldn't back a genocide of Jews because they're white and because, at least Ashkenazi are, and because, you know, Jews are deeply woven into culture here and so on. But if there was a genocide against Jews, like, most people would not vote for whoever was doing that. If Trump unleashed a genocide of Jews, like, most people, only loonies would vote for him. And it's so amazing how easily they brush this off. It's like, oh, come on, but you know, Trump's going to be worse. Like, it's not real to them, to these Democrats.
Have you ever gone on Reddit to look up Palestinian? Because most of the threads are, is it okay for me not to care about Palestine?
Wow.
I mean, it's really remarkable. And these are not the 60-year-old voters that we know have been hardened about Arab suffering. These are clearly people in their 20s who are asking their peers if this is okay. And it really shows you that this was a group that had been marked as victims. Arabs were meant to be killed from the air. That's just been a truism for American politics as long as I have been around.
And it has to be said, if the Dems lose, I mean, they're already preparing that, like that young woman screaming at the toddler. Like, they're preparing first and foremost to blame Muslims, Arab Americans, if they lose.
Yeah.
And there are so many accounts, if you follow social media, saying, I hope to see you suffer if Trump wins.
Yeah.
They will. It was there was a lot of that when Trump won in 2017.
Trump will put you in camps, and I'm going to giggle about it.
Yeah, exactly. And so if they lose, the Democrats will blame them, and Trump will absolutely fuck them. You know, he will try and kick out as many as he can. I mean, he will try to flood blue city streets with American troops. He's going to love that. That's exactly the kind of theater he and his base will love. Yeah. And it could do a lot of damage to this country. I mean, there's just nothing good coming out of anything. So if Kamala wins, you know, if Kamala wins, the way I see it, to her and to the donors and to the whole political consultant class, it's going to validate that actually turning right wing and aligning with Cheney and laying off the populist stuff and just going right wing and back towards incremental Clinton incrementalism with a hard right wing imperial kind of foreign policy, that's the winner. That's what won it for us, you know?
That and, plus norms, because that was so big a part of embracing Liz Cheney. Liz Cheney stood up for the rules.
Yeah.
And the fact that she and her clan were completely in favor of massacre wherever it seemed convenient means nothing. They have norms. They obeyed when the gavel sounded, and they are not dangerously compassionate.
Yeah, it's like if 2020 election and 2016 to an extent was, but certainly 2020 was like a confirmation that more populist politics, more that actually tried to do things for people and a change away from the politics of the previous 40 years. If that, if 2020's election was a confirmation of that, what they want 2024 to be is a complete eraser of 2020 and 2016 and a return to the status quo ante and kind of restoring like the, you know, the ancient regime sort of way, the way things were before Trump and Bernie and the 2020 election kind of mucked things up and brought in, you know, too much Democratic
the way we
hope.
Were as a theme song, man, that's perfect.
Okay, on that happy note, I think we can end this episode. Thanks again, everyone. Thank you to Ryan Grimm. Talk to you soon.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.